Following is a live presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening. Carrie Baptist is off tonight, but I'm Megan Turcato and I'll be your host. Thanks for being with us. Today we're bringing you a full show dedicated to climate change coverage. We'll talk to Bruce Cox, the Executive Director of Greenpeace Canada, about the UN Climate Change Conference, which just wrapped up in Copenhagen. We'll also be speaking with Sean Devlin of Climate Action Networks Canada about his reaction to the conference and about the recent climate change justice sit-ins in Vancouver, which resulted in a number of arrests. We'll have all this plus your weather forecast coming up this hour here on News 101. First up, we have Alice Wong on the line with us to bring us our weekday weather forecast. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Megan. So here's your forecast for December 21st to December 26th. It's time for the all-important holiday weather report. Metro Vancouver will see lots of sunshine and fairly mild temperatures throughout this week. So it's good news if you have any travel plans. However, we'll have to get through some wet weather tonight as a weakening low-pressure system moves inland. Monday evening through the overnight hours, we'll see a partial clearing in the cloud cover, but there's a 40% chance of showers or light flurries in higher elevations. Tonight's low is plus 1. Tuesday, it'll be a mix of sun and cloud with a daytime high of 4 degrees. Wednesday, mostly sunny, high of 4. Thursday, mostly sunny, high of 5. Friday, Christmas Day, it won't be a white Christmas this year, but it'll be a nice and sunny one with a daytime high of 5 degrees. As for Boxing Day, it's looking like a great day with partly sunny conditions. For everyone who will be lining up at 4 a.m. or earlier for Boxing Day sales, you've lucked out with the weather this year. That's your weather for this week and your last News 101 weather forecast for 2009. From all of us at the Storm Club, have a most wonderful holiday and new year. For News 101, I'm Alice Wong.
Thank you very much, Alice. In international news, the 2009 UN Climate Change Conference wrapped up this past weekend in Copenhagen, Denmark. Delegates from developing and developed nations spent 2 weeks trying to reach an agreement to reduce the threat of climate change. While there were some positive results to come out of the conference, it was seen as a failure by many environmental groups and activists. The conference did not result in any legally binding emissions targets, as countries have simply been asked to develop and submit their midterm, that is 2020 emission targets, by February of 2010. However, the accord includes targets of 80% reductions from 1990 levels by 2050. Negotiators settled on limiting the global temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius, which is higher than the 1.5 degrees Celsius target that many had insisted on. Many developing nations worried that the Copenhagen Accord would become a replacement for the Kyoto Protocol, but the accord does not replace the existing Kyoto Protocol, and countries will still be obligated to meet those earlier commitments. Developed nations have promised $30 billion of funding for developed nations from 2010 to 2012, which will increase to over $100 billion by 2020, and nations have agreed to reconvene in 2015 to redress targets, including the maximum temperature rise of 2 degrees Celsius. While the accord is not a legally binding document, countries will make it a goal for it to be a legally binding document by the end of 2010. The conference was the first time in history that all major greenhouse gas emitting nations met with the goal of slowing the threat of climate change. This afternoon, I spoke with Bruce Cox, the Executive Director of Greenpeace Canada. We discussed the UN Climate Change Conference, as well as Greenpeace's actions over the last 2 weeks, including the banners that Greenpeace unfurled from the top of the Parliament buildings in Ottawa. Give us your assessment of the agreement that was released at the end of the Copenhagen summit?
It was disappointing, to say the very least. I think we went into the summit with a looming crisis for the climate, and we're now saddled with both a leadership crisis and a climate crisis. I think if you look at whether we have a legally binding, fair and ambitious agreement, we got none of the above. So it's pretty hard to put a positive spin on it.
Do you feel like this was we've lost our chance to now to see a legally binding agreement that would move past the Kyoto targets, or do you think that's still a possibility?
I think it is still a possibility. I think the leaders have left Copenhagen, but there's still much to do. I think over the coming year, the job will be to actually make this, to toughen it, to make it more ambitious, and indeed make it a legally binding treaty like the Kyoto Protocol was. And that will likely happen, unfortunately, a year down the road in Mexico. So we've got our work cut out for us, but, you know, we still have possibilities to improve it and to ensure that we get it legally binding with some aggressive cuts.
What kind of specific movement do we need to see from world leaders in order to reach consensus?
Well, I think the real movement we need to see is to turn talk into action. They talk about limiting the average global temperature increase to 2 degrees Celsius, but they've got to put in place the targets and the implementation plans that will actually get us there.
Do you feel like the direct aid that they're talking about giving to less developed countries to cut down their emissions is an effective strategy?
Well, certainly developing nations need money in order to do what is necessary. And, but that is just one of the tools that we do have. Obviously, there needs to be knowledge and technology transfers. And I think we can assist some of the developing nations. But even the huge sums of money that they spoke of in Copenhagen won't be enough. And, when it comes down to it, we, being the developing world, are going to have to pony up more money in order for them to be able to do what is necessary. You know, it's kind of, around the money thing. Our government is like to say that, well, this is just, this is a cash grab for developing nations. You know, it's kind of like having a fence between your yard, you and your neighbor. You need the fence. You want the fence. The fence is going to solve a problem that you both have. But, your neighbor can't afford it. So, if your neighbor can't afford it, you may as well wrap your mind around it, is you're going to have to pay more for that fence than perhaps your neighbor is. And that's just a reality. We are going to need to assist nations like Indonesia or Bangladesh in their efforts to cut emissions.
A lot of the language of this 3-page document was focused on what developing countries could do and how developed countries would help developing countries. Is this an attempt to divert attention from pollution we're still emitting in the West?
Well, this became a rallying cry for a lot of the developed world, and particularly this was Canada's message track going into the talks and during the talks, is we need everybody on board. Well, the Kyoto Protocol actually did, in fact, have a phase-in process where developing nations would be brought on board with their own legally binding targets. But yeah, I think a lot of it was, in fact, a bit of a ruse. It's, fine for Canada to sit there and say, well, we got to have everybody on board, but just disregard the fact that we haven't done anything to cut our own emissions, and despite the fact that we've been, a decade at it, we are continuing to increase in our own greenhouse gas emissions.
So many of Greenpeace's actions are about attracting public attention to environmental issues. Why do you think this is a good tactic to fight environmental degradation?
One of the things that you need to do, first and foremost, is to expose a problem so that people actually recognize and understand that a problem exists. I think it is inherent in human nature that when people know there's a problem, they will, in fact, seek solutions and take action. What gets a lot of media attention is when Greenpeace is out there exposing a problem, doing a protest or a direct action, and that sort of grabs the media's attention. What gets less attention is for every time you expose a problem, you got to have a corresponding solution to it, and it's a lot tougher getting those solutions out.
Well, on the topic of solutions, what kind of solutions would Greenpeace suggest for the problem of climate change?
You know, there's a number of them, and one of the things to remember is there's not going to be some silver bullet single, you know, this is going to fix everything. Boy, you know, just we can get carbon capture, we'll be able to just continue exploiting the tar sands or some such thing. You know, this is a huge problem, and we're going to need multiple solutions in place. I would think how we generate energy, electricity, you know, transportation is probably key to it. We need an energy revolution here in Canada, but also globally. We got to wean ourselves off dirty fuels like coal and oil, and turn to renewable energy in terms of wind and solar and tidal power, what have you. And that will take care of a major chunk of it. But we also have to look at things like how we do transport, you know, transportation. So greater mass transit. We have to actually revolutionize how we do agriculture. And, you know, we need to have that sort of cultural change, which is also part of the solution, of recognizing that, you know, change is good. You know, it's going to avoid, you know, chaotic climate change, and change is good, and we're going to have to make some changes in our own lives, and that will include things like not being able to have strawberries in the dead of winter. So how we eat, how we shop, the things we shop for, and the fact that, you know, just a consumer society, we're going to have to slow down sort of never-ending growth in our economy through buying more, spending more, simply isn't a sustainable economy in the, well, it's not even in the short run anymore.
I guess in the past couple of weeks we heard that the Harper government was going to give breaks to the oil industry in terms of meeting even the targets that they have set. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, this is one of the problems I think Canada has had going into these negotiations. And, you know, there's a growing recognition that not only were we a laggard going into this, we said we were going to, you know, we signed the Kyoto Protocol, we ratified the Kyoto Protocol, and then we saw our greenhouse gas emissions go up significantly. But then in the midst of the summit, we find out that the government is actually contemplating policy that would see breaks for large final emitters like the tar sands in order to ensure that our economy keeps, you know, purring along as it is. So, you know, this really undermines our credibility, I think, in the long run. And I think it it creates a lot of not just apathy but distrust amongst the general public who hear their government saying one thing and then realize that they've got a hidden agenda as well.
You've been doing a lot of these public stunts to draw attention to climate change. How would you respond to critics who argue that these tactics lessen Canada's credibility on the world stage and prevent us from being, I guess, a mover in terms of building a consensus for climate change?
Well, first I'd just say they're not stunts. They're acts of civil disobedience.
Okay.
They're part of the democratic dialogue, you know, and frankly, I don't think Canada needs Greenpeace to diminish its reputation on the public stage. Our government is doing a pretty good job of it on their own. As I said, you know, we signed a legally binding agreement that said we would cut greenhouse gas emissions. We've seen them go up 26, 28, almost 30%. We are one of the worst performers of the, we are the worst performer of the G8 on cutting our greenhouse gas emissions. So this idea, this spin that suddenly, you know, NGOs and critics of the government record are somehow diminishing our ability to, you know, our credibility to have a brokered deal is crazy. I mean, you know, countries aren't oblivious to our record. They've seen how we function in these talks, the destructive role that we have played in the negotiations. World leaders hardly need Greenpeace out there pointing out the problem of the Canadian government.
Do you feel the lack of progress in terms of action on climate change is leading to, I guess, a kind of malaise among the public, and they don't feel like this is worth fighting for if we're not getting results?
I think among some, but to be honest with you, I think among more, I think they will, it's probably, as I say, it's been a wake-up call. It's probably, you know, sparked some passion and anger about where their government's coming from. You know, I think for a lot of Canadians, they probably haven't realized the fact that we are the worst amongst the G8, they haven't realized that the tar sands are increasingly becoming an international concern for their emissions, for their water problems, for everything that the project represents. So I'm actually thinking, and I'm perhaps wishfully thinking, but I'm thinking that coming out of this, Canadians will have a much more heightened sense of the problem and will be looking to rectify that in the coming months.
And you mentioned the tar sands, and that has become a very, I guess, emblematic issue of Canada's lack of movement on climate change. What do you think should be done about the tar sands?
You know, I think we need to start planning for a low-carbon future that does not include the tar sands. And, you know, you can talk about, you know, hopefully we can do carbon capture and storage, and if only we could just make them, shucks, a bit cleaner. The fact is that fossil fuels is fueling climate change, and this is one of the dirtiest sources of fossil fuels on Earth. So I think one of the first things we need to do is start looking at how we transition the Canadian economy out of a tar sands-driven economy and actually start supplying some local jobs to local communities, so that what we're doing right now is we decimate one resource, whether it's cod or you know, trees, you know, those workers are being forced to relocate into the next environmental disaster in the tar sands. And we got to stop this sort of cut-and-run kind of an economy. But probably the first thing that we could do would be to start enforcing some of the laws that we do have in Canada that would better regulate the tar sands, and we should stop giving out leasing agreements for exploitation in the future. Put a moratorium on that immediately.
Is there any last thoughts that you'd like to leave the listeners with about climate change, about the Copenhagen Summit, about what the way forward is on this issue?
Yeah, just, you know, in closing, a couple of quick things. One is, you know, the leaders have left Copenhagen, but they've left a big job to be done, and they are not going to do it unless they start hearing from Canadians that they demand more action. And I want to just really try and debunk one of the things that our Prime Minister and the Minister of Environment has been saying, which is, you know, we have to follow the United States because our economy is so intrinsically connected to their economy. There was a time in this country where Canada led, and we led on the international scene. And if people think back just even a short time to the late 80s when, you know, a conservative prime minister, Brian Mulroney, stood up and did the right thing, stood up for justice and said, you know what, apartheid is wrong. And he broke with conservative leaders around the world in saying, this is wrong, this needs to be addressed, it needs to be fixed. Could we stop apartheid? Absolutely not. But we were able to move others to action. And, you know, Canada's role at that time had a great influence on people like Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, made the president of South Africa at that time sit there and think, my God, if I can't keep Canada on board, maybe I got to start changing my ways. So this idea that we are somehow impotent, that we don't really have a big role to play on the international stage, is a disappointing thing to have our own Prime Minister promoting.
Okay, well, thanks for talking to me today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer, back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Maybe a song from a film or a tune from TV? Radio Free GAC brings you sounds of the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future and the forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Come on, baby. Come on. I won't let you down. Follow me.
Radio Free GAC. Monday evening, 7:30 till 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, Hotbox, The Kiss Store, Slickety Jim's Chat and Chew, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, The Whip Gallery Restaurant, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
Stewie, hey.
Hey there. So, it's been 24 hours. Got my money?
Oh, you know what? Just give me till next Friday. I'll have it for you.
Oh, that's funny. I could have sworn I said have it today.
Yeah, I don't have it. Sorry.
Oh, well, all right then. That's good, OJ.
Ah! Ah!
Yeah, that hurt?
Ah!
That hurt?
What the hell?
Yeah,
ah!
It feels so good.
Thank you to all the donors who pledged their financial support during the CITR on-air fund drive. Oh, we're moved by your generosity, and thank you for enabling us to purchase new equipment and improve our programming. Do remember to stop by the station, pay your pledges, and pick up your prizes. We look forward to meeting you anytime between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. on weekdays. Thank you again for your amazing response. Listen to our happy voices on the air, happier after we purchase new equipment for our studios. Thanks again.
You got till 5 o'clock. You hear me? You got till 5 o'clock.
You freaking psychopath!
Clean yourself up.
The Advocacy Office provides confidential and free representation, guidance, and assistance to students engaged in conflict with UBC. We advocate for students in preparing and attending formal meetings, hearings, and appeals against the university. Specifically, our office helps students with matters of student discipline, such as cheating, collaboration, or plagiarism, assigned standing, admissions, and financial assistance. We can also assist you in appeals to decisions made by UBC Library, parking, or housing. You are not alone. We're here to help. For more information, call 822-9855 or visit the website at www.ams.ubc.ca/advocacy.
And thank you to Bruce Cox of Greenpeace Canada for speaking with us. And that's our program for December 21st, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved in the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program. This is our last edition of News 101 for 2009. Join us at 5 p.m. on Monday, January 4th, 2010, for an hour-long edition of News 101. I'm Megan Turcato. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Track on 101.9 FM, CITR.